Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 366, titled, What's Going On Here? This is being recorded on June 30th of 2002, and it constitutes a more discussion and analysis of the events in and around September 11th. To make a long story short, I believe that September 11th is literally a continuation of the Second World War, with the Third Reich having gone underground and allied with Islamo-fascist forces in order to destroy, ultimately, and or subjugate the United States, as well as anyone else in their way. This is, of course, a complicated analysis. It rests in part upon the Nazi geopolitical concept of the Earth Island, the huge landmass stretching from the Straits of Gibraltar in Spain all the way across Europe, the former Soviet Union, the Middle East, or most of it, and all of China, India, and Pakistan. That controls most of the Earth's landmass, much of its population, most of its petroleum reserves, and across the middle of it is a huge stretch of Muslim population. One of the keys was the Nazis saw control of that population as the key to world domination. Inherent in the discussion that I'm going to be presenting is the relationship between political matters, economic matters, and military matters. Time permitting, later on in the program, we'll also get into a little bit of discussion about psychological warfare, political theory, the art of war by Sun Tzu. I realize this is a complicated analysis for background reading. I would recommend The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli, the well-known military text The Art of War by ancient Chinese military philosopher Sun Tzu, and also the book On War by Prussian military theoretician Karl von Clausewitz, about whom we will say more in a minute. Now, going to the economic aspects of September 11th, and I believe that a struggle within the world's economic structure is one of the things that is going on. In addition to the fact that an act of terrorism, such as a weapon of mass destruction, would already dampen the enthusiasm of international investors for investing in the United States, our current accounts deficit is growing and may become unsustainable. Direct net foreign investment dropped from $200.1 billion in 2000 to $2.1 billion in 2001. That's a 99% drop. Merely the threat of this is going to have an enormous impact on the American economy if the threat is not dealt with, and it already is. I would note that we're sort of between the devil and the deep blue sea. If we don't defend ourselves, we get destroyed. But if we do, we may wind up destroying our democracy. And I think that Machiavellian scenario is one of the things that we have to take into account. We're going to begin with five articles from the Financial Times of London from the very same day, that day being Wednesday, May 22nd of 2002, by way of perhaps taking a look at this particular flip comic book, and perhaps we can see some of the motion as we turn the pages. Financial Times, Wednesday, May 22nd of 2002, by way of review, this by Lydia Adetunji in Washington. It's called a mass destruction weapons attack, quote, inevitable, unquote. Terrorists will inevitably get their hands on chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons and use them against the U.S., Donald Rumsfeld, the U.S. Defense Secretary, said yesterday. Mr. Rumsfeld told a Senate hearing that Iraq, Iran, Libya, Syria, and North Korea had been aggressively developing weapons of mass destruction for some time. It had to be recognized that terrorist networks had close links with terrorist states who could supply them with the weapons. Leaving aside the fact that we've obviously got to deal with this possibility, one should understand the Skorzeny terrorist methodology that we looked at in For the Record 364, What Do You Want to Be When You Blow Up?, and understand how relatively small, irregular forces can have an enormous, perhaps decisive effect on much more powerful or ostensibly powerful elements. The investor anxiety being increased by a number of factors, including the combination of the Bush tax cut and the military buildup, the investor anxiety has been felt already. Same issue of the Financial Times, Wednesday, May 22nd of 2002, Mary Chung in New York, terror alerts accelerate Wall Street losses. U.S. equities fell sharply, accelerating losses late in the session as more warnings of possible terrorist attacks sent jitters through Wall Street. We took a look at that in the last broadcast. Very same day, very same paper, Financial Times, May 22, 2002. Ginny Wiggins in New York, James Politi in London, and Ken Higino in Tokyo. Terror fears trigger run for havens. A slide in stocks yesterday helped government bonds hold on to their gains of Monday, with investors also favoring treasuries amid nervousness over further possible terrorist attacks. And again, to understand some of the eco-political implications of the war on terror as regards the American economy, those should give us a brief insight. Bear in mind, too, the former Soviet Union was not annihilated on the battlefield, but destroyed economically and politically and psychologically. That is by way of transition to yet another article from the very same paper, the Financial Times, Wednesday, May 22nd of 2002. And one of the dynamics, I think, that can be observed in this geopolitical struggle between the underground Reich and its Islamo-fascist slash Wahhabi allies and the United States is for economic influence and political influence within Russia and the former Soviet Union. One of the main elements in this particular element of the struggle, petroleum, and the center of the Earth Island that I spoke about beforehand. Again, Financial Times, 5/22/2002, Judy Dempsey in Brussels, links with Putin leave Europe out in the cold. As President George W. Bush begins his visit to Europe today, it could be argued that Europe should be in a better mood. Germany is united, the Cold War is over, the European Union is about to embark on an historic enlargement eastwards, but collectively, America's European allies are in a grumpy mood, not only because of Washington's growing unilateralist stance on trade, global warming, and other foreign policy issues, over which former President Bill Clinton was just as unilateralist. Rather, it is Washington's very success with Moscow that is causing the unhappiness. Skipping down, quote, Europe does not have a global security role at present because it lacks capabilities, nor does it have a strategy for Russia, unquote, said Sergei Kortanov, vice president of the Moscow-based Foreign Policy Association. Again quoting, yet in the long run, it is Europe to which Russia will rejoin. Europe must be ready, unquote. The Europeans are far from ready to deal with Russia, even though EU enlargement to Eastern and Central Europe runs the risk of exacerbating Russian fears of isolation. Quote, enlargement is making the EU inward-looking instead of developing its relations with Russia, said Christopher Langton, defense analyst at London's International Institute for Strategic Studies. He argued that even though the EU bemoans its lack of military capabilities and defense spending, it could easily lease from Russia airlift transportation, the key equipment it lacks. Quote, Europe could seize that advantage, but it refuses to do so for national or bureaucratic reasons, added Mr. Langton. Again quoting, Europe should grasp Putin's pragmatism. Time is not limitless. This, again, another of the major areas of strategic struggle between the U.S., the underground Reich, and its Islamo-fascist allies. The political alliance, petroleum wealth, and military strength of Russia and perhaps other elements of the former Soviet Union, right, occupying a nice chunk of that Earth Island, are at stake here. And the fifth article, all of these from the very same issue of the Financial Times of London, Wednesday, May 22nd of 2002, again by way of looking at the flip pages on this particular grim cartoon book, so to speak. This is by Carol Ahoyos, and it's titled NATO-Russia Alliance Hits Germany's UN Ambitions. And again, notice the geopolitical maneuvering going on here. The new alliance between Russia and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization has undermined Germany's long-held ambition to become a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council, diplomats said yesterday. Quote, the new alliance will play into the debate on the Security Council expansion, said one Western diplomat. Now that four out of the five permanent members are practically NATO, it will have an impact on Germany's chances, unquote. India, which is also vying for a permanent seat at the table, has seized on the announcement. Vijay Nambiar, N-A-M-B-I-A-R, the country's ambassador to the UN, said, quote, the essential question is the establishment of a better balanced Security Council. The Russian movement towards NATO would in fact be positive in our view and would add to the rationale of India gaining a permanent seat, unquote. So note that the NATO-Russia alliance viewed with favor by India and apparently at the detriment of Germany. Just take a look at Russia and India, two major elements of the world island. Now, one of the aspects in this geopolitical struggle, and I would note that many of the largest corporations could be considered supra-political, I would also stress that I think that there is an economic struggle between American-based corporate elements and also those in Germany, rather like a struggle within a business syndicate or an organized crime syndicate for power. Wars can take place off of the battlefield and in the boardroom and in the field of investment banking. One of the aspects in this struggle concerns the accessing of the Caspian Sea fossil fuels resources, oil and gas. We've discussed the pipeline that was going to be built across Afghanistan and Pakistan, and which may still be built. The Bin Laden family was allegedly bidding for a portion of that contract, and as we looked at in For the Record 362, there is substantive evidence that Enron may very well have been acting as the broker for U.S. energy companies, this apparently known to Al-Qaeda from 1998 on. And as John Loftus speculated, this perhaps may have enabled Al-Qaeda to proceed forward with the plans for September 11th, rather like a malaria bacterium is transmitted through the blood that a mosquito draws. The mosquito isn't trying to spread malaria, it is trying to get blood, but the malaria infection can spread through that. Al-Qaeda may very well have used this bargaining by Enron and the relative silence on the part of American officialdom as an indication that they could proceed safely with the September 11th attacks, because Enron was brokering with the Taliban, according to these allegations, and that this was in order to, that this would have enabled Enron to pull itself out of bankruptcy. Those negotiations broke down in August of 2001. That's when Jeffrey Skilling resigned as CEO of Enron. The collapse came months later. Now, in connection with this geopolitical struggle, bear in mind that as we looked at in For the Record 336, the Pakistani bomb came in part from German technology, and in the Senate report to on the BCCI, apparently BCCI and Saudi Arabia played a significant role in helping to develop the Islamic bomb. As has been well known, some of the Pakistani nuclear experts involved in developing that bomb were also sympathetic to the Taliban and their Al-Qaeda masters. One of the things we have seen in recent weeks is maneuvering between India and Pakistan, who fought several wars since they became independent at the end of World War II. This war over Kashmir is something that has threatened to go nuclear. Bear in mind that if India and Pakistan get into a nuclear war, that is going to throw the whole situation of the Caspian Sea energy resources into turmoil. Any pipeline accessing those would necessarily have to go through Europe, perhaps to the benefit of the EU and its German masters. In that context, note that there have been a number of allegations. Donald Rumsfeld engaged in speculation on this count and then retrenched. There has been considerable speculation that the hostilities between India and Pakistan have been exacerbated by Al-Qaeda and that Al-Qaeda may be in Kashmir sort of heating things up. If things get ultimately hot there and go nuclear, that will significantly affect the geopolitical struggle for the Caspian Sea oil resources. San Francisco Chronicle of Sunday, June 23, 2002, had the following article by Anna Bodkhen, B-A-D-K-H-E-N. Its dateline, Srinagar, Kashmir. Its headline, Prominent Kashmiris Say Al-Qaeda Is There. It reads in part, hundreds of Al-Qaeda and former Taliban fighters are operating in the Indian sector of Kashmir, according to a member of the state's parliament and its police chief. The startling claims by Kashmiri legislator Javed Hussain Shah and top police official A.K. Suri came on the heels of assertions by India and the United States that Al-Qaeda fighters may be active in Kashmir. Of course Al-Qaeda fighters are here, Shah said. hundreds of them. And again, one wonders about the Islamo-fascist and Wahhabi irregulars in that area and the extent to which the ultimate heating up of those hostilities could lead to a nuclear war between India and Pakistan that in turn would seriously affect the geopolitical struggle for the resources of the Earth Island. And that is one of the factors that I think lies at the core of the events in and around September 11th, literally an extension of the Second World War. By way of understanding, and I can appreciate that the working hypothesis that I'm presenting here is a very, very rigorous one. I can appreciate that it's not the easiest thing to understand. I refer listeners not only to the other broadcasts in this discussion, but to the lengthy, rigorously annotated descriptions of the programs that are available on the Spitfire website in the For the Record section, www.spitfirelist.com. More about that later. In order to appreciate some of the continuities between the political and the economic aspects of the struggle and the corporate arrangements between powerful elements of the American and financial industrial elite and their German counterparts, rather like the malaria analogy, these are the connections that have permitted the infection of fascism to survive. And it has the underground Reich, literally a Third Reich gone underground, has used these connections and is now, in my opinion, in the process of attempting to do something that it has been trying to do for a long time, which is to destroy the United States as well as wiping out world Jewry. We're going to take a look at a remarkable book published in 1950. The book is called All Honorable Men. It was authored by James Stewart Martin, published in hardcover by Little Brown and Company of Boston in 1950. It is the remarkably lucid, well-written account of the man who was in charge of the economic warfare section of the antitrust division of the Department of Justice in World War II. He also was one of the key officials in charge of the economics division of the German of the military occupation government of Germany, and in charged with the attempt at decartelizing the major German industrial and financial combines. He was unsuccessful in doing this because basically the anti-communist card and the connections that existed between the German industrialists and financiers and their American counterparts remain uninterdicted. Bear in mind that on the American side of those were, among other elements, the Bush family, George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush Sr., the great-grandfather and grandfather of George Bush. On the German end, the elements that were to concretize in the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization, headed by Reichsleiter Martin Bormann, the organizational genius behind Hitler, who literally ran the underground Reich using the deadly intelligence outfit of Heinrich Müller, the Gestapo chief, and its remarkable SS resources, which worked with not only elements of Western intelligence, including the CIA, but also, as we know from Kevin Coogan's remarkable text, The Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International, these same underground Reich SS units were also working with the former Soviet Union, playing both sides against the middle. Should not be misunderstood, by the way, as constituting an endorsement by Kevin Coogan of the working hypothesis that I'm presenting here. Now, in All Honorable Men, James Stewart Martin talks about the relationship between the political and the economic, and in particular the way in which generations of German industrial and political power brokers, what he calls the eco-politicians, were able to incorporate the lessons of Karl von Clausewitz, and we'll talk about that some more later. Discussing the relationship between the military and the economic and the political, James Stewart Martin discusses the reminiscences of Chancellor Brüning, who was the last, Heinrich Brüning, who was the last chancellor of Weimar Germany, and who was deposed by the Nazi coup. Dr. Brüning's story was one of always being a step behind the events. By his own account, he never knew what hit him until after he had been deposed and was hiding out in the mountains of Austria. While gangs of Nazis combed the countryside looking for him, he spent his days reading and for the first time understanding Thucydides' classic history of the Peloponnesian War, a work that generations of British diplomats have used for a teething ring, and that Dr. Bruning had carried with him from his early youth. By the way, the Peloponnesian War was the war between Sparta and Athens in ancient Greece. Continuing. As he reread Thucydides' story of ancient power struggles, he suddenly began to realize what forces had been combined against him in Germany. How, under the pressure of administration, he had assented to decrees that weakened the, quote, equal protection of the laws, unquote, and how large-scale economic forces had made inevitable some developments he had tried to stem by, quote, voluntary, unquote, agreements among business interests. Even in the retelling, however, it seemed to me that Dr. Bruning again showed some of his former blindness. The main point in Thucydides' history was the discovery of the large part that economic forces play in bringing nations into conflict. Yet even when pressed by questions, Dr. Bruning showed no particular concern over the role of the large German industrial corporations. He related the entire story of Franz von Papen's intrigues, his posting of gunmen to prevent Bruning from seeing the aging von Hindenburg, and the other events of the last days without once alluding to von Papen's conferences with the bankers and the Rhineland industrialists who agreed to back Hitler and who put up the funds. It was, throughout, a story of politics without economics, a story of a man who had felt that no harm could come from temporary dictatorship so long as the laws and the courts protected civil rights, who showed no feeling for the ways in which great economic power and unlimited funds could get around an inconvenient legalism. And again, by the way, this is why people study history and try to draw lessons from it. In a chapter about the frustration of James Stuart Martin's decartelization efforts in post-war Germany, Martin analyzes the relationship between the political and the economic, and in particular the lessons of Karl von Clausewitz. The General Clay, referred to here as General Lucius Clay, the head of the military occupation government in Germany, chapter 18 of All Honorable Men is entitled, quite appropriately, The Decline and Fall, as in The Decline and Fall of Rome. I suspect that James Stuart Martin saw quite a few things coming in the distant future. One of the things James Stuart Martin talks about here is that the economic forces were the economic connections between the powerful German forces and their American counterparts, and the manipulation of the Cold War, and in the background, although it's not alluded to here, the Gehlen Organization and the Underground Reich can be seen in terms of their importance. Bear in mind, they were also working with the Soviets. Chapter 18, The Decline and Fall of James Stuart Martin's book, not The Decline and Fall of his book, but Chapter 18 begins, General Clay exhibited a well-developed historical sense. Yet a future generation of historians may find that, ironically, it was this sense of history combined with the lifetime habits of a military career that contributed most to the defeat of the occupation. General Clay, in my first talk with him in January of 1946, said that he was determined to make the four-power occupation succeed. He was convinced that failure to make four-power government work would be a catastrophe and perhaps the biggest single step toward a third world war. The end of battle in 1945 had signaled the start of a new kind of war, a post-war. Germany's classical military theorist, von Clausewitz, is famous for having declared that, quote, war is the continuation of diplomacy by other means, unquote. In dealing with a Germany which had gone to school with von Clausewitz for generations, we knew that, conversely, a post-war is the continuation of war by other means. Since Bismarck, wars and post-wars have formed a continuous series, changing the quality of the events only slightly from year to year, with no such thing as a clear distinction between the heat of battle and the calm of peace. This post-war of the German occupation was different from the Cold War between the United States and Russia, which broke out at about the same time. The latter complicated the diagnosis, like a man getting typhoid fever and pneumonia at the same time. In the first years of the occupation of Germany, the two struggles had not yet become confused. General Clay said the best contribution we could make to peace would be to get four-power cooperation in carrying out the agreements for the control of Germany. Later, Others with less historical sense began to support anti-Russian Germans on the theory that any enemy of Russia is a friend of the United States, unquote. The two wars became interwoven, and men who saw no difference came to make up the effective bulk of General Clay's staff. When the Economics Division chose to ignore agreements to limit heavy industry and expand light industry, this departure was necessary, unquote, to build up a strong Germany. When the French or Russians objected to economic unity under the leadership of the old line Ruhr, coal, and steel men, the same people held that the failure of the French and the Russians to live up to the Potsdam Agreement for economic unity was an act of international bad faith. Here, instead of cracking down on his own staff, General Clay let the pendulum swing. He allowed his sense of history to tell him such developments were inevitable, skipping down. It was a fair guess that confusing the Cold War with the post-war was leading to competitive wooing of the most strongly entrenched German elements. That would mean the end of reforms, not merely the end of decartelization and denazification, but of land reforms, intensive agriculture, the rebalancing of heavy and light industry, political decentralization, re-education, and the others. But the civilian and military habits under such circumstances are sometimes different. A civilian may fight back on a matter of principle and, if defeated, will resign. The military habit is to argue back until stopped by a direct order from higher authority and then knuckle under. General Clay, sensing a swing of the pendulum or a wave of the future, had held his fire in cases when he, as higher authority, had the power to give a direct order. As a result, he was steadily losing both civilians and officers who had been in charge of the reform programs. The fights for the reform programs looked like mere quarreling if the opponents of reform were not declared, quote, wrong, unquote. Yet the reform policies remained unchanged, unquote, while the reforms were totally blocked. And in the second side of this program, we're going to carry on this discussion. We're going to review some of the information about the frustration of Operation Safe Haven. That was the U.S. Treasury Department operation aimed at interdicting the flight of Nazi capital. That ultimately was to concretize into the Bormann Organization, literally the political and economic component of a Third Reich gone underground, and joined by many of these same powerful corporate forces to other elements in the United States who were to guarantee their survival in the name of anti-communism. Communism, using Alan Dulles' phrase, any bastard as long as he's anti-communist. As we know from, among other documents, the encyclopedic dreamer of the day, these same elements were working with the communists and the former Soviet Union, their ultimate target, the United States. And I believe that that moment of destiny has come, and that is what September 11th is all about. It is a battle for the survival of civilization. Learning more about this complicated working hypothesis is something that's relatively easy to do, albeit time-consuming. Check with Spitfire, CD and tape duplication service. They have all of the work that I've done on file. They can be reached at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. That's S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T.com. You can visit the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website with the two most recent half-hour segments available at www.spitfirelist.com. And in the For the Record section of that website, there are long, detailed descriptions of the programs. The programs about September 11th constitute a small book in and of themselves. They have been reformatted. Also, there are links in this For the Record section of the Spitfire website to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU-FM, wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, DaveEmory, have more recent For the Record programs streaming on Real Audio. Older programs are available for download only on a related and linked WFMU URL. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 366, What's Going On Here?, being recorded on June 30th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.